Well, thank you, Christophe, and thank you, everybody, for inviting me here and bringing me here. It's not my first visit here, but it's probably the most intensive. And it's really a delight to be with so many interesting people. I've written down a lot of individual words in my notebook about what I wanted to say, because I sort of have a scattered idea of this notion, borderlands and borders. But I think if you ask me quite literally what I see from here, what I see from here is the place that my great-grandparents escaped from, left. My great-grandparents, my mother's grandparents, came from a small village not far from here, about 30 kilometers, I think. And when they left in about 1880, I don't know the circumstances, but it was after that wave of pogroms around 1880, 1882. I'm not exactly even sure what the exact date they left was. When they left, it was not a border town per se, but today it is exactly the border town between Poland and Lithuania on the Lithuanian border. So this, to me, this place right here, is a place where my ancestors got out of. And where did they go? They went to Texas, which you might understand as, you know, the ultimate frontier state, in a sense, at least in 1880, 1882, when they went. And this got me thinking about the word border and about the English word frontier. I don't know in Polish, if there is this almost synonym, frontier and border. A border is something that sort of divides places. It's there. It may shift, but it is a division between really two, if you want to say real or static or existing places. In the American sense, or one of the American senses of frontier, it can be the border between the known and the unknown, the settled and the wilderness, the ever-expanding universe. As a Star Trek fan, I can speak about this, you know, next frontier into space. We in America use this term as a sort of definition of the American character came from this idea of frontier. And even though the frontier was declared closed in a famous speech at the end of the 19th century, the idea of frontier and limitlessness has long infused the American character and has long been part of what others see and admire, hate, envy, desire about America. Now, my great-grandparents moved to Texas through a sort of circuitous route via New York and then by ship around Florida, and they entered Texas at Galveston. And they settled in a little town called Brenham. Brenham is between Austin and Houston. And it wasn't on the exact frontier that Texas was then. West Texas was considered the frontier, and in fact, as I was sort of looking for references for this speech, I came across reference to a book that came out about 8 years ago called Frontier Texas, History of a Borderland to 1880. And it describes West Texans at that point as a region that has many transitions through the centuries, struggles and triumphs of many groups as they tried to tame the region for their own purposes. Early humans hunted mammoths and other game in the region. Then came the Humanos following the great bison herds, then the Apaches, the Comanches, the Spaniards, and the Texans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It describes this part of Texas as the archetypical frontier. If you look at photographs of Brenham, Texas, when my great-grandparents moved there, it was a multi-ethnic town that in many ways reproduced the Europe of the immigrants. It's a small town. My great-grandfather helped found the synagogue there that still stands. It was built in 1893 or 1894. But at the time that they lived there, it was a town that had ethnic Germans. It was a town that had a large black community. It was a town that had Jews. It was a town that had immigrants from various other places. There are pockets of Czechs who moved to Texas who live in that area still. And in fact, in 2005, I believe it was, I went to a days of Czech Texans in the Czech Republic, in the town near from which these people had emigrated, and they were invited back to the town to take part in the celebration of the local culture of Rožnov, which is in this sort of Valachian region near the Slovak border. And they were asked to come back and, you know, relive the traditions and bring their new ones. And what was very interesting, I recall, there's a skans in there with the old architecture and all this, so there's an ethnographic museum. And all the ethnographers were fascinated by the fact that the Czech Texans who were coming spoke Czech the way it had been spoken 100-some years ago and maintained this tradition. So they were regarding these modern-day Texans who were coming over, and since I have these deep Texas roots, I was formed part of the group. They regarded them as sort of living history books of the language. Now, going back to Texas, we have pictures of my grandfather looking like he's in a shtetl holding a cow, holding a leash to a cow. And speaking with other elderly relatives in the past, I've, you know, heard their stories of being peddlers on the road. It's almost like a sort of recreation of Europe in a different landscape, but in a freedom that didn't exist here. Now, I have, Krzysztof mentioned the work that I've done describing how there's been a reinvention of Jewish culture, and in many cases, a reinvention of Jewish life in Europe, particularly over the past two decades. And what I've particularly focused on is the way that non-Jews, whom I sometimes refer to as virtual Jews, sort of take the place of the Jews who no longer live here. They, just like, you know, the synagogue we were in last night doesn't have a congregation anymore, but the townspeople and the theater form the congregation. So there are different roles that are played in a virtual way. It's not Judaism, but there's a Jewishness involved, and it's a reinvented or invented, in many cases, not just recreated but created phenomenon. And it's what I sometimes call the creation of a new authenticity that takes place sometimes in spaces that I call real imaginary spaces. Because there's spaces that are really real, but there's an imagination or an imagined quality of these spaces, because even what is evoked is not what it's modeled on. The pre-war life is not what we see re-evoked or evoked or presented as it is today. And this goes for the most famous example is what goes on in Krakow. But there's another aspect of this phenomenon that I also have done a lot of research on. And it's something that goes on, you know, today. And it relates to frontiers and lack of frontiers, borders, and the sort of invention or reinvention of identities based on other cultures, and in this case on myth and fantasy. And that is the embrace of the mythology of the Wild West, the American Wild West, the American frontier, by Europeans. And I see this also as a way of dealing in borders of self-awareness. The frontier takes on this role as the ideal. As I say, it takes on a mythological aspect. The great historian of the American West, Ray Billington, described the United States, America, as a land of savagery and a land of promise at the same time in the minds of Europeans. And it's exactly what we still see today. There's a sort of love, hate, you know, desire and revulsion about America that comes through, but a lot of it was really set in stone in about 1838. And what I have looked at a lot is the way that people here today in Europe really find themselves in this mythology. And just in a similar way, but for different reasons, I mean, obviously for different reasons, that the so-called virtual Jews, or people sort of find themselves in a study or an embrace or an interest or a performance of Jewishness. A lot of people, a surprising number of people in Europe, find themselves in the performance and embrace of this Wild West mythology, country music, and all of that. I have a friend in Slovakia who's a Slovak country music singer who lives on a ranch and raises horses and wears cowboy hat. There are many other people like that. I have a friend in Warsaw who's a Polish country music singer who developed this way of his lifestyle in the communist times. We met originally in about 1982. And he tells me, you know, every time he put on a cowboy hat and his boots, he was giving the finger to the regime. And it was nobody could do anything to him for it, but he found his identity, or he found his freedom in this. And this is what people over and over and over have said to me when I ask them, what do you see in this frontier mythology that's so appealing? And over and over and over again, they talk about freedom. And it is, for many of them, the freedom of not having strict borders. You talk to truck drivers. There's a big, or there's a shrinking, but it was once big, trucker scene in Europe where truckers dress up like cowboys and play country music, and they have sort of transformed the identity of a lone cowboy riding on the range to the lone truck driver riding at night on the highway. And for many of them, the ideal of the long, lonely highways in the United States without borders, where you could drive for a week and still be in the same country, for them was like, you know, heaven. And it was the ideal, because here everything is very regulated, and until Schengen, you had to stop every few hours just to get anywhere. So that's somewhat, I mean, it fits, I think, into this idea of the borders of self-awareness, or the way we construct who we are, which a lot of people have been talking about at these discussions. As I said, I don't think it's people find themselves in American country music, and I don't think it's a coincidence that two of the most popular American country songs, which I have heard sung in German, in Czech, in whatever other language you might think of, are Sweet Home Alabama and Take Me Home Country Roads, because people feel that home. And I mean, 3 weeks ago in Slovakia, in Trnava, the Slovak band played this song, both of those songs, and brought the house down. Everybody's singing along. I want to just, if you allow me 5 more minutes, I just want to return to my return here and read a brief little essay. It's quite brief, that I wrote on my first return. I can't even call it return, because I was coming here for the first time. It's the first return of anybody from my family since they got out. And I came back in 1999. And I just, if you give me 5 minutes, I'll read it, because I think it's returning to a place that they wanted to leave, but I like coming here. And I think this is sort of what I am today, is I like being here. I feel the landscape. I feel the pond. I like it here. But I'll just read it quickly, and that will be it. It doesn't have to do it. Doesn't have anything to do with the cowboys, though. On a frosty November morning, I walked around the two massive ruined synagogues that form a unique surviving Jewish complex in Kalvaria, a small sleepy town in southern Lithuania on the border with Poland. One of the synagogues was built in the early 18th century. Its roof had fallen in, and its bottom windows were bricked up, but it was possible to see arches and other architectural detail and decoration. The other, built in about 1803, was more or less intact but crumbling. Between the two stood a red brick building, a former rabbi's house, and a cheder, or Jewish school, with a big Star of David above the door. As I have done in hundreds of other cities, towns, and villages in more than a dozen countries, I took pictures of the synagogues from every angle. With my eye focused through my camera, I didn't watch where I was walking. Suddenly, I tripped over a broken brick, half buried in the uneven yard, and went crashing to the ground. Trying to save my cameras, I ended up twisting my ankle so that I could hardly walk. The injury took weeks to heal fully, but everyone, including, I think, Krzysztof, told me that my spill was beshert, fated, and maybe it was. Kalvaria is the town from which my great-grandfather, Pesach Sosnitsky, emigrated some 120 years ago, ending up in the small town of Brenham, Texas. In Brenham, Pesach became Philip. He was the patriarch of a huge family of children, including my grandmother, who was born in Brenham, and a pious pillar of the Jewish community. In Brenham, he helped found a Jewish congregation. The little wooden synagogue that was built in 1894 still stands. When he left Kalvaria in about 1880, Jews made up more than 80% of the town's population. By 1939, it had dropped to about 25%, but still about 1,000 Jews lived in the town. No Jews live there today. And I must say that given the depressing and bloody history of the town and region during World Wars I and II, and decades of later Soviet domination, I am enormously thankful that my great-grandfather had the courage to leave when he did. Still, the buildings I was photographing were not just fascinating sites of Jewish heritage in general. They were the places where my ancestors worshipped and studied. The streets of the town with their small, mainly low wooden houses, and the central square dominated by a big white church with two ornate towers, were the streets and squares where my ancestors walked. I had driven there with a friend after spending the night near the Polish town of Suwałki, about 20 miles to the south. Until a few years ago, such a day trip from Poland to Kalvaria would have been difficult, if not impossible. For one thing, this is 1999 I'm talking, American citizens today do not need a visa to enter Lithuania. While Kalvaria is the first town in Lithuania across the border from Poland, the border crossing point was opened only 4 years previously. I didn't have a real genealogical agenda for my visit. I just wanted to see the town. But I had hoped to spend much of the day walking through the quiet streets, poking into corners, and possibly talking to local people. My injured ankle cramped my capabilities, though, and here's where the beshert comes in. An old woman told us where the Jewish cemetery was located, on the other side of the river that winds through the town, and my friend and I decided to drive straight there. Pesach Sosnitsky died in Texas in 1939 at the age of 83. Several years ago, I visited his grave in the Jewish cemetery in Brenham. I had little hope of finding any Sosnitsky graves in Kalvaria, but I was eager to visit the cemetery just to see it. We found a small, fenced-in, triangular plot of ground right in front of the huge electric grid, which contained several dozen simple tombstones, some of them toppled. Hobbling, I started photographing the site, and just then, an old man came by, wheeling a bicycle. "I know everything, everything," he smiled. All his teeth were capped in gold. "I remember everything how it was." He propped up his bike and began to talk. He described how the cemetery used to extend much, much further, stone after stone, all the way down to the river. But the Germans destroyed it, and most remaining stones were stolen. Now on top of the area, there are ugly, poor barracks where people live, with no indoor plumbing. They have to walk 50 yards or so to the toilet. Pigs and dogs frolic around. A man passed by leading a cow. Of the remaining graves, the only mausoleum, he said, was that of a certain Menashe who was a millionaire. I asked the old man if he remembered the Sosnitsky family, and he did. "Of course. There were a lot of Sosnitskys here, a lot. Particularly," he said, "before the war, there were two Sosnitsky brothers in town, Alter and Yankel, who must have been nephews or great-nephews of my great-grandfather Pesach. Alter was a big, tall man," the man said. "Yankel was small, curved over, and he had a hunchback. He demonstrated, scooping out his own body. The brothers lived together in a big house on a hill," he said, "and then he led us there to see it. Indeed, it was one of the most imposing wooden houses in the village. Undergoing some renovation, it even sported a satellite dish. Both brothers were killed when the Germans deported the Jews to nearby Mariupol during the World War II," he told us. The old man said all the houses on this street were occupied by Jews, and that Jews lived all over the town. "So many, so many," he just gestured forlornly. He was clearly nostalgic for past times, and the disappearance of the Jewish community represented for him a change for the worse. Nonetheless, in describing the Jews in town, he used the term Zedek, a term Jews regard as very pejorative. The Jews in Calvaria, he said, were good people and wealthy. They took care of each other, and everyone got on with everyone. They were called Yankele, Alterke, Menashe, Meshke, he recalled. They would say, oy vey, oy vey. Thank you.
Dziękuję bardzo, Ruth Gruber, za to spojrzenie z pogranicza tej, która chce tutaj przyjeżdżać, żeby nie powiedzieć powracać, mimo że jej przodkowie nie chcieli tutaj żyć i stąd wyjeżdżali. To, co powiedziałaś na początku o tej różnicy między border i frontier, bardzo ciekawe. My często się spotykamy z takim problemem językowym też w tłumaczeniu naszej nazwy fundacji, że bardzo często nas się tłumaczy na angielski Borderline Foundation. No i bardzo często odnosi się to imię, tą nazwę właśnie do takiej linii rozdzielającej, oddzielającej i wtedy ciężko nam wytłumaczyć, że chodzi o borderland, prawda, i że to jest zupełnie inne odniesienie. Może to pojęcie frontiers byłoby tutaj właśnie dużo bardziej adekwatne.